Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/WashingtonWise. That's schwab.com/WashingtonWise. You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Does your dad know the dude?
Yes.
Can we get the dude on the
list? Can we now call him the dad?
Hello, welcome to another episode of the Weeds on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm Matthew Iglesias, here with Jane Costin, ProPublica's Dara Lind. And we were going to talk today about enthusiasm, because as Donald Trump has lagged in the polls fairly substantially, this has come to be sort of something he's hung his hat on. His campaign put out a memo showing, I mean, which I think is true, that there is more Trump enthusiasm detectable in the polls than there is for Biden, saying that the candidate with the more enthusiasm almost always wins. Admittedly, like, the exception to that rule was that you had to go all the way back in time to the 2012 election to find a case of the less enthusiastic candidate winning. I have relocated to coastal Maine, which very excitedly is a swing area. This is a county that voted for Barack Obama twice, but voted for Trump in 2016. Joe Biden's hoping to win it back. It is definitely true that, like, a non-trivial number of people out here have Donald Trump signs in their lawn or Trump bumper stickers. And you see some, like, old Hillary H's or some Bernie stuff from different eras, but, like, there's no Biden merch around. We were talking about Twitter and the K-Hive earlier. There are no real, I shouldn't say there are no Biden stans on Twitter, but, like, it's two people.
Right. I generally, walking around DC, I saw a car where the entire back of the car was just Joe Biden stickers and Joe Mentum stickers. And my first conclusion is that is a person who works for the Biden campaign. But Matt, I want to go into, because you wrote a really interesting piece on the enthusiasm gap with Latino voters, but we should start first and foremost by talking a little bit. It seems obvious to ask this question, but why is enthusiasm an important metric? An enthusiastic vote and an unenthusiastic vote still count the same way? And looking back at 2012, which I think is actually an interesting comparison point, because the 2012 election was one in which Obama is like, okay, so things did not go quite as planned, but you still had the idea of Obama. And I think that what you're seeing from the Trump campaign now is kind of the idea of 2016 Trump, which has led to the Trump campaign basically pretending that Joe Biden is currently president, which has been interesting. But Matt, could you explain a little bit more about why does enthusiasm matter politically?
Yeah, I mean, one possibility is that it doesn't matter.
Right, which is, I think that's my view I've started to take.
But so I do think there's a couple areas where it could matter in theory. And the question is, will it matter in practice, right? One is that there's a ladder of political engagement of which voting is sort of the lowest rung, but donating money to a campaign is another rung. Volunteering for a campaign is probably an even higher rung. Doing things like, as far as we can tell, things like public displays of support do have some electoral impact. So it's like the signs are both an indicator of enthusiasm, but also themselves have some kind of impact. And then I think, you know, when I was looking at sort of the Latino electorate, although other low propensity voting groups, it matters because there's like an adage in life, right, that enthusiasm is contagious, right? And so like one question is always like, why does anyone ever vote for anybody? Right? Because like, yes, it's important and like civics and blah, 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 blah. But the odds that your vote will matter are so infinitesimal. Most states like aren't even swing states. It's not a super duper rational calculus. And consequently, like tons of people don't vote. Like I think around half of people typically don't vote. But for those of us who do vote, it's like you vote either out of some basic habit. Like I always vote. I'm a super voter. But the people who only sometimes vote, I think it's very plausible that what their more politically engaged friends are saying and doing and signaling is itself relevant, right? So it's like, if I am voting dutifully, then somebody who is less dutiful is likely to not vote at all. Whereas if I'm like enthusiastic, I'm talking to my friends all the time about how great this is, I'm sharing all the memes, I'm wearing the t-shirt, right? Like that builds more sort of like, you've got to do this, you've got to go kind of get on the bandwagon. And, you know, Biden is not, as far as we can tell, I mean, he's at a financial disadvantage to Trump, but his fundraising is good.
Right.
And a lot of Democratic Senate candidates are doing well. So I think in the most concrete sense, like Democrats are probably going to brush this off because that's where you would, campaigns like to raise money and they would be upset. Right. If you were leading in the polls, but somehow couldn't raise any funds at all, you would worry that your lead is going to go away because you get buried in attack ads. And that doesn't seem to be like a proximate issue at the moment.
I mean, I think that there's also the very relevant fact that this is not going to be a normal election because normal elections don't happen during pandemics. Like, we don't know what the state of COVID-19 is going to be in early November, but given that even as of a month or 6 weeks ago, there was concern that a summer lull would be followed by a, you know, like a second wave in fall, and B, the fact that we don't have the summer lull in much of the US, this is an election that's going to have, you know, more people wary about going physically to the polls and waiting in line than most of them have. And it's an election that's going to have, you know, we've already seen, in some cases bipartisan, in some cases only pushed by Democrats, efforts to radically expand voting by mail, to make it, you know, to expand access to voting alternatively to just showing up on election day. And in that case, it actually makes sense that enthusiasm might matter a little more because you're raising the activation barrier to voting. If you're going to vote by mail, you're going to have to request a mail-in ballot in advance or request an absentee ballot. Those are hard things that require a little more forethought and a little more prior commitment to just like waiting and seeing how you feel on election day. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if that's going to be a bigger problem for lower propensity voting groups and for the candidates that rely on them. But it wouldn't surprise me at all if a particularly motivated electorate is going to be more likely to request those mail-in ballots in advance. The other complicating factor here, of course, is that taking mitigation efforts against COVID-19 at both the political and personal level has become super politicized. And so we are seeing isolated evidence of Republicans being much less likely to request and use mail-in ballots than Democrats are. So where I kind of run up against the enthusiasm question here is, yeah, Donald Trump has voters who would, you know, there's like this quote that a Trump representative gave a reporter in one of the wave of articles about, you know, why Trump is about Trump privately being very concerned about his polling numbers, saying, you know, our base would walk through fire for Donald Trump. No one would walk through fire for Joe Biden. Like, that is true. You know, whether they will take personal risks in the midst of a pandemic to vote for Donald Trump is less clear. And whether they are going to do the most likely, the thing that is easiest to do to avoid the you know, the health risk while still voting, because that's been turned into a, you know, a ripe for voter fraud, only Democrats do it tactic is also unclear.
So I went back a little bit to it was funny reading this piece because it feels like it was written 6,000 years ago, but it was written in the first week of March by 538, talking about the enthusiasm gap for Biden and in comparison to Bernie Sanders. The people who voted for Bernie Sanders were overwhelmingly enthusiastic for Bernie Sanders, but not enough people voted for Bernie Sanders. So I'm interested in this question because Dara mentions, you know, we're doing this election in the midst of a pandemic, but we're also doing something that I'm interested to see what you guys think about this, because I remember 2004, I was in high school, and I remember that campaign, Kerry's campaign, was somewhat for John Kerry, but largely against Bush. And the enthusiasm numbers that we're seeing right now are people being extremely enthusiastic to vote against Donald Trump. But I'm interested to know and to see what data we have on, we've talked a lot about negative polarization and kind of if there is such a term for negative enthusiasm. But I'd be interested in seeing, you know, as Trump's numbers go down and as Trump seems to be overwhelmingly focused on not just his base, but like the basiest elements of his base, the base who's like, no, we don't really care that much about Infrastructure Week. We're very mad about statues, which appears to be mostly a very online base, but I'm interested in that kind of the negative enthusiasm and what role that could potentially play in November.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, there's tremendous antipathy to Donald Trump, right? Like, unprecedented. And, you know, we've had George Floyd protests and Black Lives Matter marches, but a couple of years ago, we had these National Women's Marches,
right,
which, you know, I don't want to say that there was not a, like, content to the marches, but I think that those were really best understood as, like, pure anti-Trump kind of mobilization. And there was tremendous enthusiasm for that exercise, right? Like, incredibly large numbers of people came out and wanted to go do that. Protests that were not spurred by, like, super specific issues or news events. 2018 had historic midterm turnout for Democrats. You've seen incredible levels of small donor mobilization all up and down the ballot. It's like there is a real anti-Trump political mobilization that has been happening for years. Something the Trump campaign's memo actually led me to think about for the first time is, like, they were saying, okay, the candidate with the more enthusiasm has won every time except in 2012. So if you then break that down, that means in 2000, Al Gore got more votes, but he lost enthusiasm. In 2004, Bush won votes and enthusiasm. In 2008, Obama won votes and enthusiasm. In 2012, Obama got more votes, but had less enthusiasm. In 2016, Hillary got more votes, but had less enthusiasm. And that just sort of starts to seem like a pattern where there is structurally less enthusiasm for Democrats, even when more people prefer them, which might just be a sort of straightforward consequence of the coalition being more diverse. And it's like, it's harder to be inspiring to all different segments of the Democratic Party coalition simultaneously. And the only person who, like, ever did that was Barack Obama, who, like, in one of his two races, not, like, all the time, right? And he didn't stop being a good public speaker or, like, a charismatic person or the historic first Black president, but it was, like, that very special nexus of circumstances, which was special. Like, I remember in DC election night, you know, I went out of my house, all the, like, young white gentrifier people on U Street were out partying, as were all of the African Americans of all ages who lived. It was a Blacker neighborhood at that time, and it was great. It was like all kinds of Democrats were, like, so fucking happy about Barack Obama. But that's, like, a really weird kind of circumstances. Whereas Republicans, it's like, if you got, like, some white guy and he wins, like, Republicans are really excited about that. And I just don't know if, like, Democrats can do that. Like, can you be all things to all people in, like, a self-consciously diverse political party?
this is also relevant because Republicans are the party that, you know, as that, like, certainly in the pre-Trump era, was relying less on those kind of intermediate levels of involvement to motivate other people. Like, the ground game has always been, has in recent memory been more important for Democrats than for Republicans, because they're dealing with, again, a more diverse coalition, a coalition that includes lower propensity voting groups, like Latino voters, like young voters, and having the bodies to execute that ground game depends on having people who are enthusiastic enough that they're going to, like, take more than the hour or several hours, depending on where you live, that it takes to vote. So it's not super clear to me what Republican enthusiasm on the margin has meant, you know, in a pre-2016 world. That said, one of the truths of, you know, the 2016 election is that Donald Trump managed to turn out low propensity white voters. And it is true that there are people who probably wouldn't be motivated to vote who are going to be motivated to vote because Donald Trump is on the ballot. Whether there's anything that can be done to activate them more is really unclear. And this is where the Trump campaign's strategy to kind of keep that base as angry as possible starts to run into some math problems, because yes, you can do that, but if you've already gotten them as fired up as they're going to get, and I haven't seen any argument that there are disaffected Trump voters who can be reactivated by this culture war stuff, then the question becomes, how many people are you assuming aren't going to show up just because they don't love Joe Biden? How much is this actually assuming that there's going to be other kinds of suppression involved, that it's going to be harder for voters in heavily Black areas to vote than it is for white voters because of, you know, state restrictions on polling places and voting hours? How much are you assuming that your people are just going to be less turned off by the coronavirus than, you know, Democratic voters are? Like, there do seem to be a lot of assumptions about election day behavior that aren't just about enthusiasm, but are about all of the other factors that we think about when we talk about turnout. Like, if they're essentially betting that everything happens up to and including it's raining on election day, because we know that that suppresses turnout among low propensity voter blocks. And I'm not super sure that all of those assumptions can hold, which is, again, why it kind of raises the question of, are you actually just assuming that states will do more to limit and suppress voting?
One thing that you mentioned there was, you said you haven't seen evidence of, like, a disaffected Trump voter block out there. And I know, Jane, like, you've done some pieces a kind of social conservative grumbling about John Roberts. I mean, I guess Trump is one of the grumblers, so where that disaffection lies, but, like, what have you learned?
It's important to recognize that when we're talking about Trump voters, that there's kind of I put it as, there are Trump voters who, like, bought the album, and there are Trump voters who bought the album and follow him on tour, which is literally true. There are people who follow Trump rallies across the country, or did before the pandemic hit. Like, there are, like, the true fans, or stans, as it may be. And those are different groups of people. And so when I'm talking about the disaffected Trump voter, I am not referring to the people who are, like, super hardcore all in and are now like, no, no, no more. That's not that many people. And that is certainly not enough to win a presidential election with. But what I have, in the conversations I've had, there have been, Trump has a challenging job in many ways, which is that we don't think about it this much, but the GOP tent is a lot wider than we think it is. And as you know, the Democratic tent has also widened with people who feel as if they've been pushed out of the Republican Party by Trump. But Trump has brought in a bunch of people into Republican Party politics who probably never thought of themselves as being quote unquote conservative before. And so what you're seeing now is that a lot of social conservatives who are very focused on the Supreme Court, which is what I wrote about most recently, are very disappointed because and it's not just Trump, it's 30 years of essentially being told that if you vote for these people, we will nominate these judges who've been approved by these conservative organizations, and ipso facto eventually will overturn Roe versus Wade and other abortion precedents before the Supreme Court, and bring social conservatives back to the halls of power, conceivably. And that hasn't happened. And so I think that there's a sense among some social conservatives of a great disappointment with the entire plan on which the social conservative political project has rested. But what that has to do with Trump is that Trump in 2016, in response to Ted Cruz, who essentially argued repeatedly that Trump couldn't be trusted with the votes of social conservatives and might even nominate his sister to the Supreme Court. So Trump made the Supreme Court a big part of his 2016 pitch. But if the Supreme Court doesn't, quote unquote, show up for social conservative voters, I talked to some people like, what's the point? Why would we even vote? They likely still will. This is a group that's a very consistent voting bloc. But I think that that gets to one of the things about politics is that it is inherently transactional. You vote for something with the hope that someone will do the thing that you want them to do. And for some Trump voters who voted for him for various reasons, a lot of those transactions have been, say, not paid. And so I think that what you're seeing is that there are among the people who voted for Trump, not because they thought Trump was the coolest, most awesome person in the history of collective time, but for the people who were like, I'm very concerned about industrial policy. I'm concerned about fentanyl. I'm worried about immigration. There is, and obviously there's been a lot that's happened that the Trump administration has done on all of those matters, for good or for ill. But if you voted on those specific things and you were promised something and that didn't happen, it's not that you're going to go vote for Joe Biden. It's that you might not vote at all. And so I think that it's a challenging issue because I think that disaffection is sometimes hard to read in the voting populace because disaffected voters might still vote. I talked to some people who were saying, I'll vote down ballot, but I'll leave the top part blank. I won't choose between Trump and Biden and anyone else. I just won't vote for president. Or these are people who used to give a ton of money to Club for Growth or a number of right-wing organizations, and they aren't doing that anymore. Or it looks like, I used to have bumper stickers on my car for this and I don't anymore. And so all of that may not be obvious in what actually happens on election day in November or afterwards with all the mail-in ballots. But it does show a shift. When you have a presidential campaign that was supposed to and is again focusing on the Supreme Court, and you're hearing from some social conservatives like, we've been focused on the Supreme Court for 35, 40 years, and what has that gotten us in their view? I think that that poses somewhat of a challenge.
So my question about this is always, given what we saw in 2016 and the total failure of elite conservatives to direct the party to choose a nominee who was satisfactory to elite conservatives at that time, I find myself asking them and what army question about any conservative constituency that appears to be overrepresented among elite commentators and not have an identifiable voting bloc, right? I think that it is absolutely plausible that the people who were fans of, putting conservative judges on the court before it was cool, and who have tried to make their peace with Trump by saying, but judges, and are now realizing that John Roberts is less enthusiastic about overturning Roe v. Wade than they hoped he would be, that they might be having, that they may not vote for Trump in November. But A, very few of them, unlike the kind of ex-Republican Lincoln Project types, the Bill Kristol types, are saying, I'm going to vote for Joe Biden because it's extremely important. We're going to get this man out of office. And it's not entirely clear how many of them there are. So if we're talking about people who are A, not having as much, they're only having half the impact because they're not voting for Trump, but they're not voting for Biden either. And also, we don't know how many of them there were to begin with. I do have real questions about, is this just professional conservatives showing again that they do not actually drive the bus, that Trump is driving the bus?
Yeah, and the related point about that is that I just feel like the kind of people who follow Supreme Court cases and know who appointed which justices and like how this all went together. Those are exactly the kind of people where you say like an unenthusiastic vote counts as much as an enthusiastic vote. And that like, that's the margin that they are really on, is the like, oh my God, this is great. Or is it a like, eh, we got to do what we can because that RBG vacancy is coming up, right? Whereas the different margin is like the, you know, sporadic voters, right? And when people in their community are excited about something, right? Like clearly Donald Trump, right? Like the Trump movement of 2016 felt to a certain segment of the population, I think primarily rural whites who hadn't gone to college and who weren't very religious, right? That there were a bunch of people in that demographic who previously had seen American politics as not engaging them, right? A kind of a war between woke big city liberals and these like churchy Southerners. And they were like, I don't know, man, like they just don't get it. And then Donald Trump came on and a lot of people who fit that description were like, yes, this is for me now. Republican Party politics, like people have MAGA hats. We're going to build a wall, right? We're going to be like, we're going to stick it to the feminists, but not really in a churchy way, right?
Right.
In a Donald Trumpy kind of way. And so there were like, there were people who really liked that and like got engaged in American politics as something that was relevant to them. But that just doesn't strike me as like the kind of people who care about John Roberts's.
Right, exactly. That was something I, in my piece on social conservatives in the court, I talked about how there was, even describing this debate seems strange, but there was an article on a conservative outlet called The American Conservative that described the website OnlyFans, which is widely used by adult film performers. And the author made the argument of like, this makes me wish that we had essentially a like Islamic regime in this country to make this stop happening. And in response, an adult film actress wrote an opinion piece in The Federalist describing her own conservatism as like sex and rock and roll Republicans, as, you know, we don't really care much about, you know, these specific ins and outs of social conservatism, and all of these Christians trying to push us out is just going to make us mad. But, you know, we love God and we love drinking and we love listening to rap music and complaining about Nancy Pelosi. And, you know, this, we all support Donald Trump. And, you know, when you're trying, you, how dare you talk about the millions of Republicans who enjoy pornography.
This is a porn actresses for Trump?
Yes. 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 And so, but I, you know, I made the point that essentially if you have a tent that is supposed to include social conservatives who want to ban pornography and are asking the attorney general to like get gear back up obscenity prosecutions, and then you also have an adult film actress named Brandy Love who is talking about how like, you can't ignore my fans, you can't talk about this. I'm like, I don't know how you get all these people together. And clearly one of these groups of people cares a lot about the Supreme Court and thinks a lot about Amy Comey Barrett and thinks a lot about like how Neil Gorsuch may have betrayed the conservative movement. And the other group absolutely does not. And somehow the Republican Party is supposed to make both of these groups happy, which they've attempted to do so with culture warring that doesn't require anyone to do anything. There's a great piece Matthew Walther wrote about the new social conservatism that is essentially like, you know, if you have someone who just says, I love the flag and the Me Too movement has gone too far, that isn't asking anyone to do anything. So the Republican Party responds with that and with tax cuts. And so I think that that is a challenging line to walk, and the Republican Party has just decided not to.
So this gets back to the enthusiasm, the question of whether enthusiasm matters, because you have just described a constituency that is all fired up and that like and has nowhere to go, right? Like that nothing is being asked of them because they are fired up, and like arguably maybe that is the secret sauce here. Maybe it's much easier to express enthusiasm to a pollster when you know that enthusiasm is just a matter of like being angry on the internet and not like, oh, let's see, am I committed enough to this candidate to go, you know, to spend some hours phone banking? I'm not. Therefore, I am going to say I'm not that enthusiastic. But because of the fannishness of the kind of Trump constituency, it is not surprising that they're at super high enthusiasm levels. But like, there was a lot of discussion in the first term of the Obama administration of whether they could build the political infrastructure that could turn the 2008 coalition into a durable Democratic coalition. And the conclusion, both in terms of like individual, you know, Organizing for America kind of organizations that were supposed to be that infrastructure, and in terms of the broader political project, was that that did not work. That, like, as Matt was saying earlier in the episode, there was just some kind of alchemy in Obama as a candidate that you can't replicate with really good party organization, or that the party organization just wasn't that good. There hasn't been a lot of discussion of, is the Donald Trump campaign or campaign for 2020 trying to build something durable, or are they relying on, are they assuming that their candidate has the same kind of alchemy? And like, if they do assume that it's the same kind of alchemy, that's not just about the people who are super all in for the president now. That is about the, you know, again, that's about turning out every single person in Florida who voted for your dude last time, even the ones who are like older and concerned and telling pollsters they are concerned about the coronavirus, even as they say they're likely going to vote for Donald Trump. Like, it's a very tricky thing to, you know, it's a very tricky needle to thread. And I'm not, I think that the Trump campaign, you know, could be doing, you know, like, I'm not, obviously, like, they have their theory of the case, but it seems plausible that if you asked more of some of these big fans, like if you asked them to encourage others to vote by mail, if you asked them to, like, you know, to phone bank for Trump, to go out there on election day and like drive people to the polls and that kind of thing, they would probably be willing to do it. But the disinterest in running a conventional campaign appears to be so deep in Trump world just because they did it okay once, that it's not, you know, I'm wondering if they're essentially leaving enthusiasm on the table by not mobilizing it.
All right, we desperately need to take a break. So let's do that. And then I want to talk about the Hispanic vote, because it's weird.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media, pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context, and it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics, or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAP. That's NAPP. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
So as Biden has opened up this kind of big lead in the polls, as you would sort of expect when somebody is running 7 to 8 points stronger than Hillary Clinton, he is generally running stronger with all kinds of people. He's running stronger with white people. He's running about even with African Americans because there's only so low you can go there. But Biden reversed sort of small gains that Trump had made with African-American men. Biden's doing better with old people. He's doing better with women. He's doing better with men. Biden is doing maybe even with Latinos, probably worse than Hillary Clinton did in 2016. Is this a very controversial subject in the polling community as to specify exactly what the 2016 election results are? But suffice it to say that that's what it hinges on. There's one baseline according to which Biden is currently doing flat with Hillary, even as he does better with everyone else. Another baseline according to which he's actually lost ground. And it's strange because, you know, Trump has obviously not expressed a lot of enthusiasm for Latino contributions to the American cultural mélange. And also, unlike with African Americans, like, there has been this somewhat hilarious, like, Trump black outreach throughout the course of his presidency, which has been offset by a lot of sort of fairly overt racism, but it's clearly a thing that they have done. Whereas there has really been no, like, now Donald Trump is going to try to show, like, Mexican Americans or Puerto Ricans or any group of people other than Cuban emigres that he cares about you at all.
Even Venezuelan emigres.
Sure, yes. Okay, right. a related kind of issue. And when you delve into the polling, though, I mean, it's a quite broad phenomenon. It's not a Florida-specific sort of thing where there's been, right, a little bit of a Trump bump. And some of it comes from the fact that for, at least at the time the polling was done, there was just less concern about the pandemic among Hispanics than there was among white voters. I think most of the people I spoke to just expected that that would change as the locus of the outbreak moved to Texas, Arizona, and California, you know, which is, that's just the kind of thing where you just have to follow up. But it was paired with the fact that it was just very low levels of, like, awareness of Joe Biden, who is not exactly an unknown figure on the national stage or like a fresh face who we desperately need introduction to. But for people who, you know, is a very working class demographic, it's a demographic that has some people who are not super fluent in English and has generally had lower levels of attention to American political news than white or black people. And the thing everybody said was just people did not have, Latinos did not have a strong impression of Joe Biden. So it's not an enthusiasm, but also not a, like, specific lack of enthusiasm, more just like a genuine lack of enthusiasm. Like, they'd heard he was the guy who wasn't Donald Trump. Who's to say, right? And it's left a lot of Democratic pollsters concerned that Biden is going to be defined very much by negative advertising about him. Because we're not getting a, like, precisely because Biden is so well-known, like, notionally well-known, people aren't doing stories, like, cover story, like, what's up with Joe Biden, right? Like, it seems like such a boring assignment. He's not being, like, introduced to the public in some exciting way. There's nothing interesting about the, like, old white former vice president becoming the Democratic Party nominee. Nobody's, I mean, like, how do you do it?
It's also true that, like, Donald Trump, any given 24-hour period that is not about Donald Trump is met with an effort to make the next 24-hour period about Donald Trump. Like, it's not just that Joe Biden is, like, both well-known and kind of vanilla as a brand. It's that Donald Trump is doing a very successful 5-year running effort to make everything about him.
Trump loves attention in a slightly odd way. Anyway, it was interesting to me because I am absolutely 100% part of the like political media problem here, where it's like Joe Biden has been a national political figure literally my entire life. So the idea that like people need more information about him would just not have occurred to me. But of course, lots of people don't pay that much attention to politics. And like, yes, he's an important politician this whole time, but he's never been the focus of attention, including now when he's likely to become president of the United States. There's like not that much talk about Joe Biden and like who he is or what he might do. And it's a little bit of an odd situation.
It's challenging because what this ultimately means for November, we don't know. And I'm fascinated that, yeah, and all of this, all of this conversation about enthusiasm, this conversation about how people are defined, it's particularly challenging because I think that we've seen from Trump that his play is, I'm going to go after just my voters, and not even my voters from 2016, the people who are enthusiastic about me right now, in this present moment. And everyone else, deal with it. And I think that the Biden campaign has a challenge because, as Matt put it, how do you define someone who is largely defined for many voters, but not for the voters you want to go after, but you don't want to get into an entirely new conversation about who this person is, but you kind of have to so that the Trump campaign doesn't redefine him. And I don't know, it's such a challenging question to ask, you know, ask like, how do you reach out to new voters, keep your voters, and keep the opposition at bay all at the same time?
Especially because I am familiar with the idea of you can't, negative mobilization doesn't work. You can't get people to the polls solely based on let's beat the other guy. Like, I am familiar with that being a truism of politics because of the Latino vote over the last like 10, 15 years, right? Like, there is so much evidence of pollsters and Latino activists calling out the Democratic Party for trying to mobilize Latinos, not by promising them things, but by saying you don't want the other guy to win. And then like Latinos don't turn out, like 2014 Senate races being a pretty good example of this. It's just the you don't want the other guy message is not we know for sure that it's not going to work with this particular group of voters. And like, it's interesting to me that a lot of the argument for Biden kind of among people within like Democratic elite circles was he's a known and familiar figure. He's not going to need reintroduction. You know, Trump won't be able to define him. And like, there is evidence that for whatever reason, gee, I wonder, Donald Trump has not been as able to, you know, label Biden as he was Hillary in the eyes of the public, even though Hillary Clinton was also, of course, a well-established political figure. So there is a way in which that's working, but the fact that they're now encountering this issue with Latino voters makes me wonder why that didn't come up during the kind of informal vetting process that was like Democratic discourse about the primary. Like, why wasn't anyone thinking about this a few steps in advance?
I mean, I do think they were thinking about it, you know, and it's like Bernie Sanders really cleaned up in primaries with Latinos for various reasons. But like, one reason is that he spent a lot of money on that project, which turned out to not be that well optimized to the goal of becoming the nominee, which is like one reason people don't necessarily do it all the time. But you know, I think the point about negative mobilization and its sort of failure for Democrats with that demographic group is interesting, because it's probably not true that it doesn't work like at all, right? Like, there was clearly among the phrase like suburban women, quote unquote, is used a lot to describe this demographic, but I think that's imprecise, right? But there's a cohort of sort of college-educated women professionals, you know, mostly white, because that's the educational attainment yes. profile in the United States, but right, who were very negatively mobilized by Donald Trump in the 2018 midterms. It was really noticeable. Women candidates did way better in Democratic Party primaries than they had done before. There was a huge amount of campaign contributions coming from women, right? And that was a clear negative mobilization case, right? Like a story existed in people's minds whereby the rejection of Donald Trump was an affirmation for themselves, right? In a way that positive voting sometimes is for people. And like, so you can form political identities around negativity. It's just that like what Democrats have tried to do with Hispanics has not succeeded at that. And one thing that I was always struck by when I wrote a piece a few years ago, it was looking at polling on, do you think that diversity makes America like better? And among white people who identify as liberals, that's like off the charts, right? Like a really constitutive element of liberal identity for white people, I mean, which is not that many white people, but like if you are white and you identify as a liberal, saying that diversity is an affirmative good is like really, really big. For Hispanics, that's not at all the case, right? Like the numbers on that are not super high. So the way that white liberals think about immigration and its interplay with the existence of Latino people in the United States and that interplay with American politics is just like not the same as how working class Hispanic people themselves see politics, right? It's almost like white people have this affective enthusiasm for the idea of like importing a new demographic cohort that is supposed to help white liberals slay conservatism. And I don't think that's, that like instrumentalized view is not, I think with good reason, not how like actual native-born American citizens with immigrant parents or grandparents see what's going on. And it's often discussed in a weird way. Like I sometimes feel like Democratic campaign operatives don't realize that like by definition, only American citizens are allowed to vote.
I mean, I do think that this is something where we're gonna have to see how the next like decade plays out, because it is generally true that the existence of Hispanic or Latino as an identity category to begin with, as opposed to just like people, you know, people mobilizing on behalf of their like national ancestry groups, is a like synthetic construction that's made in part by kind of by anti-Latino racism. And so I think that the jury is still out on whether the kind of resurgence of white, like of a white nationalism, is going to mobilize native-born and longer resident Latinos in a way that we wouldn't have seen like 10 years ago. I don't necessarily think that that's going to show up in the 2020 election, because something you hear a lot in kind of like in Latino kind of voter mobilization is like, you don't have the, if you don't have a repeated practice of voting, it's just not something that occurs to you. If your parents didn't grow up like going to the polls every, you know, every first Tuesday in November, then you are less likely to think of it as, oh, of course, that's something I'm going to do. And like, that's obviously relevant not only for people whose parents were non-citizens, but for people who were in like relatively disenfranchised communities. So I'm not sure that just feeling like more Latino, so to speak, or feeling more commonality with recent arrivals than they might have felt under the in the Obama era is going to show up in the polls. But I'm not sure that the kind of split you're postulating between the like New Mexican who's been here for, you know, whose family has been here since before it was, you know, since it was Mexico, and the person who's like just who, you know, came in 2014 and settled in New York. I think that that divide is not as real as it used to be.
Break white paper.
Yeah,
sounds good.
Let's do it.
Support for the Weeds comes from Hydro.
So I hit the gym in the mornings, and let me tell you, it's often a battle not to hit that snooze button again. And I'm sure I'm not alone in this. With Hydro, you can squeeze in a fast 20-minute workout. According to them, it'll work 86% of your muscles. Hydro is a state-of-the-art, low-impact home rowing machine that's actually designed by rowers. Sarah Frank is my colleague and works on the business side of things at Vox. She got to try out a Hydro. Here's what she thought.
While the Hydro workouts only took about 20 minutes, after I was done, I really felt like I probably had been working out for at least an hour. I could really feel the burn from my arms to my core to my legs, and it felt like I was getting a really efficient workout for my time.
This spring, you can join the growing rowing community at Hydro. You can head over to hydro.com and use code WEEDS to save up to $400 off your Hydro. That's HYDROW.com code WEEDS to save up to $400. Hydro.com code WEEDS.
Listen, I'm 24 and I still live at home. Like, what? For sure. Are you kidding me? My man and I, we attempted to move out.
Yeah, that'll be $1,600 for a studio apartment, not including groceries.
Last fall, the National Association of Realtors released data showing that housing affordability had fallen to its lowest point since the 1980s for reasons of economy, American.
There just aren't a lot of home sales going on. And there's really kind of a standoff right now between buyers and sellers.
That standoff leads to another kind of standoff.
It's always fun being 40-something years old and having to live with your parents again. And I know it's all my fault.
Sir, I don't know your life, but on Today Explained, a two-part series on how it might not be your fault. Our housing reality bites and the American dream is in your childhood bedroom. Series sponsored by Mint Mobile. Today Explained, in your feed every weekday.
And I'll tell my mom, Mom, I'm going to the bathroom, I'll be back. If I'm not out in like 3 minutes, dog, she's like knocking on the door going, everything okay in there? Yeah, Mom, everything's cool, dog.
So our white paper for today is from Giovanni Facchini, Brian Knight, and Cecilia Testa, and it is called The Franchise, Policing and Race, Evidence from Arrest Data and the Voting Rights Act. And this is a fascinating paper because it shows that Black arrest rates fell in counties that were covered by legislation that was included in the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and also had a high rate of newly enfranchised Black voters because of the Voting Rights Act. And this largely focuses on the issue of sheriffs. There's a quote in this that from the president of the National Sheriffs Association, where he says, "So as opposed to a sheriff being appointed by a mayor or city council and being beholden to that city council, we are beholden to the people. We see our bosses as citizens that elect us." And it's fascinating because it talks about all sheriffs in the South and many municipal police chiefs are directly elected. So, for example, the sheriffs that you may know best, for instance, Sheriff Joe Arpaio, elected and then defeated most recently. And law enforcement also helps to, you know, the impact that law enforcement has on the treatment of minorities and department culture with regard to minorities has been well established. But this paper shows that when more people are able to vote, the Black arrest rate drops. And because these arrests are carried out by sheriffs who are elected by these newly enfranchised Black voters, that indicates a fascinating relationship between arrest rates and the people who are chosen to be sheriffs by the people who have just gotten the voting rights.
Yeah. You know, something this made me think of is structural racism is very much a vogue topic to discuss at the moment, and often is discussed in fairly complicated kinds of ways. But like one thing you saw with the Voting Rights Act was that when African Americans could not vote, that was discriminatory, but it also had downstream consequences due to a lack of political power. And just an obvious glaring fact about the United States of America, right, is like we have 50 states and each state gets two senators, but there's no Black majority states, right, even though it's 13% of the population. And in fact, states with almost no African-American population are greatly overrepresented in the Senate. You see all this gerrymandering in state legislatures, right? There's like a million different features of the geography of American politics that dilute African-American voting power in ways that are not as explicitly discriminatory as the pre-Voting Rights Act Southern disenfranchisement dynamic, but that are pretty, you don't need to do a lot of like self-examination to see that the Senate map is going to underweight African-American voice in American politics. It's like, it's right there in the contours of the lines and just kind of generally accepted as a feature of American society. But like, of course, like the political system is responsive to people's voting power, right? If you just like gave left-handed people like six times as many votes as right-handed people, like something would happen as a result of that, right? Like it actually matters quite a lot in like a really, in a way that's almost like too crude and obvious to be worth like writing a book about or doing a lot of like really interesting discussions. But it's such a salient feature of the American political system that like white votes count for more. And it seems bad.
Yes, that is definitely true. I think it's worth calling out. I mean, I really appreciated the structure of this paper. It is not common that the paper starts with, here are all of the tests that we did. You usually have to like see that way down in the bottom. And so props to the paper authors for that one. But it's worth, you know, like it if you're interested, obviously it'll be in show notes, it's worth skimming. But, you know, it's worth calling out that they're finding routinely that white arrests are not at all dependent on these factors, that like there are kind of both black and white arrests increase over the time period, but black arrests increase only a teeny bit, whereas white arrests increase a bunch. The time period they're comparing is the early 60s to the late 70s. So like given crime rates during that time, that makes a certain amount of sense. They're also finding that disparity reduction is concentrated in misdemeanors. So like on the very logical assumption that police have more discretion to arrest in misdemeanor cases than felony cases, like it's reasonable to understand, to kind of look at what they're showing in terms of pre-VRA black arrest rates and say, okay, a lot of that is police harassment of black people. But the fact that white voters are kind of structurally overcounted and that they're political preferences do not appear relevant to how often white people are getting arrested is fascinating. Strongly suggests that crime policy is like not as much about immediately felt safety as it is about kind of broader racial control. And it's also interesting to think about this as like when you're talking about sheriffs versus police chiefs, like, yes, generally they're elected versus appointed, but police chiefs are being appointed by democratically elected officials. And the idea that just that extra layer of insulation, where instead of electing a sheriff directly, you're electing a mayor who's going to appoint a police chief, that creates so much insulation from the community that you can just continue to, in a heavily black, you know, in a heavily black jurisdiction that is covered by the Voting Rights Act, continue to, you know, arrest black people at like wildly disproportionate rates, and that no one will punish you is definitely something that I think we should be thinking about as we go into this, like an immediate round of local organizing around policing, where city council members are being pressured to, you know, to cut police budgets, where mayors are being pressured to fire police chiefs. If that is going to have an impact, that's a very different finding than what we're seeing in this white paper, in which, you know, just having one layer of, well, if you're not literally the person being elected, it doesn't particularly matter. You know, you can continue to do what you were doing police-wise and not face a political repercussion from the black community.
I mean, it makes me wonder about salience, though, right? That, you know, if you're having a race for sheriff, then obviously questions of what the police department should be doing are right. going to be highly salient in that election, like all the time. And maybe just nobody will vote in the sheriff's election because they don't care about policing and crime control issues. But to the extent that you are going to vote in the sheriff's election, it sort of has to be because you care about the sheriff's department and its conduct. Whereas there are a lot of different things happening in municipal politics. And, you know, issues sort of float up and down the agenda. Like right now, this summer, like the conduct of police departments has become a very high salience political issue, which, you know, in my lifetime has been the case sometimes, but mostly in the early 90s when the violent crime rate was very, very high. And people, there was intense, like, ordinary, normal people like wanted to put in mayors who would represent themselves as like going to be able to do something about that. But then, you know, for most of the 21st century, it just hasn't been a big deal in municipal politics, right? Like the crime rate was floating downward from a relatively low level, and people were worried about schools or bike lanes or a million other things. If you turn police reform into a front rank political topic, it's possible that it starts to look more like sheriff's elections. And then the question is like, what is the staying power of that mobilization as other things, you know, kind of come and go in life? And, you know, there's a lot on a given mayor's docket. Although interestingly, I mean, the police department is something that at least in formal terms, the mayor has a lot of control over in a way that they sometimes don't over other things that people are interested in.
I do think, though, that the issue of, you know, crime salience seems largely untethered to what the crime rate is actually doing at any given moment. And especially in municipal sheriff's elections, in which, you know, you are, especially in areas in much of the South where sheriffs are widely elected, where the crime rate in the area that the municipality actually is extraordinarily low, largely because the population is low, and yet the concept of crime remains like a really useful cudgel. I think that decoupling happened a long time ago, in which you can run as a tough on crime sheriff in an area that has very little crime, and at no point will anyone point that out as being a kind of a strange argument. So I think that remains a particular challenge, and that, like, even how we talk about crime or crime rates or what causes crime to go up or down, I think that gets tied into this in a way that's fascinating, because the salient, you know, whether or not police reform remains salient, the concept of crime and what to do about it is, in my view, always salient.
I mean, I think that one of two things is true. Either the kind of overwhelming weight of these like trends over the last half century, where crime isn't consistently a high salience issue to most people, where it is easily hijacked by the politics of law and order, you know, where the people who are most affected by policing practices are politically less enfranchised and therefore less able to do something about it. And the people who are more enfranchised don't care as much and therefore are likely to like make choices based on feelings or affect rather than based on the consequences of those policies. Like, either all of that is going to continue to be true and it's going to doom the current efforts for policing reform or reimagining or abolition or like whatever noun you want to stick there, or we are looking at a generational shift in which a critical mass of white people in the left and center left understand law enforcement not as an issue of crime but as an issue of racial justice and increase its salience accordingly to them, so that it's no longer an issue where the people who really care about it are the law and order folks, where the mobilization is primarily happening in the left, center, left. And then, like, a lot of things can get done that were previously unimaginable, but also a lot of these trends that we're talking about that have been true for a half century or more are going to have to get reversed, or like will consequently be reversed. And we don't know how. You know, we don't know where things are going to settle. But the weight of the evidence is pretty strong that generally, you know, that like just a lot of things are going to have to change about how people make electoral decisions in order for the kind of current push to go anywhere in the long run.
All right.
Yeah.
It's a long run.
Sorry.
Thanks, guys. There you go. We'll just have to see how it all plays out. Dara's always looking forward to the future.
I'm always uncertain about the future. It's not quite the same thing.
All right. Well, fair enough. Thanks to our sponsors. Thanks to our producer, Jeffrey Geld. And the Weeds will be back on Friday.